ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 27th of March. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, Julian Assange in limbo again. His supporters are calling on the Australian government to ramp up the campaign for the WikiLeaks founder's release. And poverty while on placement. Calls to pay social work students who are doing months of unpaid work and living through dire financial circumstances.
We don't expect young men in hard hats and high-vis vests on construction sites to be doing their apprenticeships without remuneration. If we pay apprentices in the blue-collar side of the economy, we should be paying apprentices and trainees in the pink-collar side as well.
First today, the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore has been described as one of the cathedrals of American infrastructure. Yet when it was struck by a container ship, it crumbled in seconds. It's left a city and a nation shocked and many asking questions about why more protections weren't built in to guard it from the many heavily laden cargo vessels that pass under it. Six road workers who were on the deck of the bridge at the time of the crash are presumed dead, but quick-thinking policemen who stopped traffic to the bridge are being applauded for preventing a bigger tragedy. Alison Shaw reports.
Bystanders captured the shocking moment on their mobile phones.
Yo! What the f***? No way! The Francis Scott Key Bridge just got hit by a cargo ship.
Around 1:30 in the morning local time, the Singapore-flagged container ship Dali ran into the pylon of the bridge, sending it crashing into the Patapsco River below. The ship headed for Sri Lanka apparently lost power and went off course, and the crew issued a mayday call just before the impact, allowing police to stop traffic. But eight people were on the bridge when the ship ploughed into the structure. Two of them have been rescued, but six people remain unaccounted for. Coast Guard Rear Admiral Shannon Gilreath says authorities are not expecting to find any survivors and are suspending the search and rescue operation.
Based on the length of time, the extensive search efforts that we've put into it, that at this point, we do not believe that we're going to find any of these individuals still alive.
The accident has raised concerns about whether this could happen again elsewhere. Ian Firth is a British bridge designer and says he's not surprised that the bridge collapsed so comprehensively.
It's not designed to carry the kind of impact force that a ship like that would impart. And those bridge supports are just not designed to sustain that kind of impact.
Andy Herman, a former president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, told the BBC that bridge design has improved since the 70s, when construction began on the Francis Scott Key Bridge. The Baltimore Bridge began operations in 1977, 3 years before a freighter downed a main bridge in Florida, triggering stricter design standards on bridge building.
In 1980, we had the Sunshine Skyway Bridge in Florida, and it was hit by a large freighter, and it came down similarly. And in the 90s, they came out with a guide specification. It was updated in the 2000s and is now part of the code.
The Washington Post's global economics correspondent David Lynch says part of the investigation will look into the bridge and its structure.
It is the second bridge worldwide just this month to have an accident of this sort. There was one in China in Guangzhou that suffered a similar mishap. And some people have raised questions about the extent to which this aging infrastructure, which of course was designed and built well before these mammoth container ships, most bridges, so far as I know, in some of your key ports, particularly New York, New Jersey, do have protective structures around their base to protect them from just this sort of episode. But it apparently wasn't the case in Baltimore.
The tragedy also triggers memories of a similar disaster here in Australia, when a large ship crashed into the Tasman Bridge in 1975, killing 12 people. Bill Lawson is an engineer who worked on the reconstruction of that Tasman Bridge and says it wasn't rebuilt very differently. Instead, new protocols about ship movements have been put in place.
Tasman Bridge is very vulnerable to shipping going through it. When the ship goes through Tasman Bridge now, it's got to be escorted by two tugs, and all the traffic is stopped and all the pedestrians are stopped. And the reason for that, it is dangerous.
Beyond the human cost of the tragedy, the collapse of the bridge has closed one of the busiest shipping hubs on the US eastern seaboard. Peter Morisi is Professor Emeritus of International Business at the University of Maryland.
This is the largest East Coast port. So this is kind of as close as we get to the Suez Canal. There really isn't any place on the East Coast that can take this kind of cargo. So this is a major deal. Everything comes through here. Everything. Whether it's automobiles or toothbrushes.
U.S. President Joe Biden says he's directed his team to move heaven and earth to reopen the port and rebuild the bridge, which is a major highway in Baltimore.
It's my intention that federal government will pay for the entire cost of reconstructing that bridge.
Debris from the bridge needs to be cleared before ship traffic can resume at the port, and it's not clear how long that could take. President Biden says 15,000 jobs depend on this port.
Alison Schau. Refugee law experts have labelled the federal government's controversial immigration detention changes the most draconian shift in decades, and they're calling for a pause to consider the long-term impacts. Political debate is raging about the federal government's move to rush legislation through Parliament, which would jail non-citizens who don't help the Australian authorities return them to their home country. The experts say the move to criminalise the migration system is unprecedented globally, as Stephanie Smale reports.
If the federal government's proposed laws get through, non-citizens who don't voluntarily leave could end up in jail for at least a year. The legislation is being rushed through this week, and the Shadow Immigration Minister, Dan Tehan, says he's worried about the lack of transparency.
What is the rush? What is the need for these laws to be passed through the Senate today? We couldn't get a clear answer on that. Is the government trying to hide something? And we want to make sure that if we're going to pass legislation, that there has been full interrogation of all aspects.
The legislation has been introduced ahead of the High Court case of an Iranian man who won't cooperate with efforts to deport him. Energy Minister Chris Bowen, who was Immigration Minister in the Gillard government, argues it's not unusual for immigration-based legislation to be put relatively quickly through the Parliament. He argues there's a growing backlog of people who should be returned to their home country that needs to be fixed.
No case to stay in Australia, no grounds to stay as a refugee, no grounds to stay on family reunion, no grounds to stay on skills, but says effectively, bugger you, I'm not going home. I think it's appropriate that the government has a better toolkit.
So these are some of the most draconian migration laws that this country has seen in decades.
Daniel Gezelbash is the Deputy Director of the Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law at the University of New South Wales. He says the legislation will criminalise the migration system and it's based on flawed assumptions.
It's kind of based on this premise that our asylum processes are fair and effective in identifying people who need protection. And we know that that's not true, particularly the fast-track regime that the government has used in the past.
The federal government is arguing this is a long-running issue and it's time to fix it. How else can the federal government deal with people who aren't eligible for a visa or haven't been able to convince the Australian authorities that they can stay?
I don't know any other government around the world that has resorted to criminal sanctions designed to coerce people to cooperate in their removal. The approach that's generally taken is either through, you know, diplomatic means, entering into agreements with the countries of origin to accept returns. And the approach there is generally through inducement rather than threats and coercion.
Daniel Gezelbash concedes a functioning return system where people who aren't genuine refugees are returned to their home country is important. But he says thousands of people could be affected by this legislation, particularly those who arrived by boat before 2014. And he argues a blanket ruling isn't fair.
There needs to be an opportunity to be able to consider how the person's circumstances have changed and how the circumstances may have changed in the country of origin. And also to take into account the fact that they've been allowed to remain in the country for so long means that they've laid down roots here and may have Australian citizen or permanent resident family members. It's crucial that these factors can also be considered in the removal process.
The new legislation could also give the federal government the power to stop processing visa applications from countries which refuse to accept involuntary deportees from Australia.
Stephanie Smale. Supporters of Julian Assange are urging the Albanese government to ramp up its calls for the WikiLeaks founder's release. Another twist in the case has left Julian Assange again in a legal and diplomatic limbo between the UK and the US, only weeks after the Australian Parliament called on both allies to bring the matter to a close. The ball's been put back in America's court, as Jacqueline Breen reports.
One way or another, his supporters thought they'd know this morning if Julian Assange could soon be on a plane to the US, but they don't. Australian lawyer and longtime Assange supporter Greg Barnes.
It's certainly an unusual move, but of course this is an unusual case.
Instead of a final decision on his extradition appeal, the UK's highest court has asked Washington for some diplomatic assurances first, including that Mr. Assange wouldn't face the death penalty if convicted, and that he wouldn't be prejudiced at trial because of his nationality, unable to argue a free speech defence on constitutional grounds. Jennifer Robinson leads Mr. Assange's legal team.
It remains to be seen why the US, in 5 years of pursuing this case, whether they will grant those assurances, given they haven't given them to us in the 5 years they've been pursuing this extradition request.
The US Justice Department's yet to comment, with the British High Court requesting an answer in the next 3 weeks. But Mr. Assange's supporters argue that any assurances from the Americans shouldn't be counted on, and that they're politically and morally beside the point. Greg Barnes again.
This shouldn't be a case of diplomatic assurances. This should be a case in which the United States says the case is coming to an end because it is an attack on freedom of the press.
Mr. Assange faces charges under America's Espionage Act relating to WikiLeaks' publication of thousands of classified military documents, some of which exposed American war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. Prosecutors argue that lives were put at risk by the publication of unredacted names amidst the material. The case has dragged on for over a decade, but in recent years, calls for Mr. Assange's release have been coming from across Australia's political spectrum. Independent MP Andrew Wilkie brought a motion to Parliament last month calling on the US and the UK to bring the matter to a close, a motion backed by the government and the Prime Minister.
I sense that that is the view in the British government, that this has gone on long enough. And I guess the White House is also sick of the issue and would like to clear the deck.
Earlier this month, a Wall Street Journal article called the issue a political hot potato for the Biden administration and reported that the US Justice Department was exploring a plea deal based on lesser charges. Mr. Assange's brother, Gabriel Shipton, says his lawyers haven't been approached about any deal, but that there seems to be evidence that the political pressure is having an effect.
I think now is the time for the Prime Minister to really ramp that pressure up and not just make these isolated representations, but to really take Julian's case into all their diplomatic negotiations with the United Kingdom and the US.
Jennifer Robinson says the Australian government's advocacy hasn't gone unnoticed in Washington, but now's the time for more of it.
If the Australian government is making this clear that this is a priority, then we ought to get a resolution. And it would be disrespectful to our relationship if the United States continues to ignore the Australian government in their requests.
If no assurances are forthcoming from the US, the extradition appeal will go ahead in the UK. If they are, there'll be another hearing in May about whether the court finds them satisfactory.
Jacqueline Breen. On ABC Radio across Australia and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. There's been a setback in the cost of living battle, with official figures showing the annual inflation unchanged in February. The Bureau of Statistics' monthly inflation gauge remained steady at 3.4% in the 12 months to January. So what does this mean for interest rates? Business reporter David Taylor joined me a short time ago for some analysis. David, the price rises in the economy have been increasing at a faster rate. What sort of items are causing consumers the most pain?
Rachel, this is an interesting set of data because we're looking at a snapshot in time and we're comparing it from the 12 months to January to the 12 months to February. And some items have been included in this basket that haven't been included in the previous basket. And most of those items are services. So it's services in the economy, think education and healthcare, that are doing the most damage. Also, if you look at housing, the cost of housing was up 4.6% in the 12 months to January. It's also up 4.6% in the 12 months to February. So no easing in the financial pain there. When you look at insurance and financial services, it's gone from 8.2% increase to 8.4% increase. So a little bit more pain there. But Rachel, where it gets really uncomfortable is rental prices. In the 12 months to January, they were up 7.4%. Compare that to the 12 months to February, up 7.6%. So more pain for renters. As far as electricity prices are concerned, bit of an easing of financial conditions there. Prices were up 0.8% in the 12 months to January, only up 0.3% in the 12 months to February. So a little bit better there.
So inflation, as far as the Reserve Bank is concerned, is moving in the wrong direction. What do you think the RBA will make of this latest development in terms of its interest rate decisions?
Rachel, the Reserve Bank is not concerned with volatility. It's a steady ship and it wants to make a reasonable policy decision. In that vein, it will be looking at the headline rate of inflation and it wants that to be between 2 and 3%. But a good gauge of where inflation is heading is the trimmed mean. It sounds very technical. But basically, it smooths out inflation over the longer run. That's what the Reserve Bank's interested in. Now, if you look at that, it's increased slightly in the year to February. It was 3.8% in the year to January. It's moved up 0.1 of a percentage point to 3.9% in the year to February. Overall, economists say it's a mixed result in terms of inflation. I spoke to the chief economist of the National Australia Bank, Alan Oster, a short time ago.
You can look at things like rents, what's happening to transport, health is sort of strong. But against that, if you're looking at things like household equipment, services, it's going backwards. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, really. But I don't think it really changes much in terms of the rate outlook as we go forward.
Just on that, where does the National Australia Bank have interest rates or the Reserve Bank beginning to cut interest rates following this data set?
We haven't changed it, so we still see it in November, and then we have best part of four cuts in 2025. So sitting and watching for a while.
NAB Chief Economist Alan Oster there. So, Rachel, a lot of figures there, but basically we're no closer to seeing the Reserve Bank cut interest rates than we were earlier today.
David Taylor. Social work students are dropping out at an alarming rate despite significant workforce shortages. The qualification requires the equivalent of 6 months unpaid work placement, which can drive students into poverty and massive debt. A new report suggests the federal government should intervene. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Anna Garcia is in her second year of a Master's in Social Work at Queensland University of Technology. This year, she'll have to do 500 hours of work placement to graduate. Not only will the work be unpaid, she'll lose out on other income, and she'll have to pay for full-time childcare for her young child.
It's very stressing. Financially, it's a big burden for me and my little family. And basically, there is very little support.
Anna Garcia estimates the cost of completing her placements will be at least $10,000.
So my way of thinking is like, well, you know, I will just max out my credit cards, ask for a loan, and just get through it.
She knows she's not alone.
I have very good friends and very close peers who are basically facing homelessness, they are in poverty circumstances.
Christine Morley is a professor at the School of Public Health and Social Work at Queensland University of Technology. She's researched poverty amongst students who need to do 1,000 hours of unpaid placements as part of their social work degrees, equivalent to 6 months of full-time work.
Students talked about reporting losing tens of thousands of dollars in wages. 96% of students said they didn't have money for food or medications or other basic necessities.
Professor Morley points out that social work has high numbers of First Nations students, students with a disability, women with caring responsibilities and mature age students.
The unpaid placements are either causing severe financial hardship or causing students to defer or drop out. And we have data now to show that unpaid placements are also a disincentive for students to enrol in professional degrees like social work.
Despite a high dropout rate, it's estimated that Australia will need a 23% increase in social workers over the next few years. The Australian Council of Heads of Social Work Education has commissioned Think Tank Per Capita to find a solution. Emma Dawson is the Executive Director.
We looked at a range of measures, and the one we have landed on as being the most equitable, the most inclusive, the simplest to legislate, and most appropriate to their needs is a stipend. So the government, the federal government, would fund a stipend equivalent to the minimum wage and including superannuation that would be paid to the host organisations, which are often non-profit services that host these students.
That way, international students would also be able to access the payments. It would cost an estimated $91 million a year, but Ms. Dawson sees that as an investment in the workforce. She argues there's a strong gender argument to be made too.
We don't expect young men in hard hats and high-vis vests on construction sites to be doing their apprenticeships without remuneration. And so there's really a gender imbalance here. If we pay apprentices in the blue collar side of the economy, we should be paying apprentices and trainees in the pink collar side as well.
The recently released Australian Universities Accord recommended the Australian government work with higher education providers to introduce financial support for placements.
Alexandra Humphreys. A government agency dedicated to the well-being of families has challenged faith leaders to do more to combat religious abuse. A new report by the Australian Institute of Family Studies suggests perpetrators of religious abuse are known to use sacred texts or ideologies to manipulate or control victims who fear ostracism from their community if they speak out. Oliver Gordon reports.
Victim survivor Emma still remembers her lowest point.
He got my Bible and ripped it in pieces. It was something that was so precious to me because of my mom. She had gifted that for me to carry it for the rest of my life.
Emma, who's a Christian, was in a relationship with a man of a different faith. He didn't approve of her religious beliefs and used his own to belittle and intimidate her, even commenting on the food she'd eat.
I will get some type of verbal abuse. Look at you. You look like that because of what you eat. You're fat because of what you eat. Don't give my son to try any type of food that you eat because that's shit food, he will call that. Everything was just about his religion and his traditions and food.
The abuse still haunts her.
Even though I am out of that situation after 3 years, I am still afraid of saying I'm Christian.
Religious and spiritual abuse is the focus of a new report by the Australian Institute of Family Studies, a government body which conducts research into the well-being of Australian families to inform government policy. Report co-author and research fellow at the Institute, Dr. Mandy Truong, says evidence of coercive and controlling behaviours can be found across a range of religions.
So that may be using practices around their religious teachings or texts to justify, excuse or minimise abusive relationships, to keep their victim in an abusive relationship. It might mean isolating them from religious activities or communal worship. Or also forcing people to convert to a different religion. Some people may use religion as a tool to ridicule someone for their beliefs, to undermine their identity or self-confidence as well.
The report has been welcomed by Rabbi Zalman Castell, whose organisation Together for Humanity encourages people from different faiths to build commonality.
Yeah, as a religious leader, I can see how people can interpret the same religious texts in different ways. And it often says more about the person doing the interpreting than the text itself.
Tell me more about that.
Well, you can read Genesis that says a man will dominate his wife as a license, or you could read it as a problem to be careful about understanding that religion would require deep respect between spouses and equality in the ways that people behave towards each other.
He says it's incumbent on religious leaders of all faiths to stamp out religious and spiritual abuse.
I would urge people listening to this report to fight abuse in the name of religion, but also not think that just because someone uses religious language to justify their disgusting behavior, that it's motivated purely by religion. People are complex and we're driven by lots of different motives. So in closing, we must not exaggerate the role of religion in comparison to other drivers of abuse, nor should we minimize it.
Rabbi Zalman Castell from the organisation Together for Humanity, ending that report by Oliver Gordon. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. A government plan to partly fund a big ritzy new stadium in Hobart became one of the most contested issues of the Tasmanian election on the weekend. Today, Cos Samaris, the director of polling company Redbridge Group, on why voters have had enough of paying for sporting venues. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.